Three men hung on crosses outside Jerusalem. But one was markedly different from the others. Two were despised thieves, while one was a popular teacher. Two had been tried and declared guilty, while the other had been pronounced innocent. Two were ignored by the crowd who taunted and ridiculed and mocked the other. Three men dying the same death, slowly, painfully, on crosses upon a hill outside Jerusalem. One was different, but not just because he was a popular teacher while the others were despised thieves, or he had been pronounced innocent yet died there while they had been declared guilty and were executed. It wasn't just that the throng of people who encircled the crosses directed their ridicule and mocking towards that central cross, while the other two were ignored and indeed actually entered into the ridicule of the central cross. No, that man who was on the central cross was different. His death was different, significantly different. Those men who died each side of him had no choice. They died of necessity. Indeed, we could say that even the throng of people that surrounded that cross would necessarily die. For the scriptures tell us that it is appointed for everyone to die. Because, as it says elsewhere, the soul who sins shall die. You see, there is no choice in death. Not one of us here this evening has any choice in death. No one in this whole world has any choice in death. We will all one day die. It is the inevitable conclusion of our existence in this world. Oh, but you say, there are people who choose to die. There are people who go off to war. They fight for their country. They die. And we remember their deaths. But not one of those men purposefully went to die. I would be fairly confident in saying that every one of those men hoped to return home alive. They may have chosen to fight for their country, but they didn't choose to die. Whether they died on the battlefield or having returned home at some later point, they would die. Very well, you say, but what about the person who commits suicide? Did they choose to die? No, they don't choose to die. They choose the place. They choose the method. They choose the moment. But they don't choose to die. Whether they hang themselves cut their wrists, threw themselves in front of a train, or died at some later date peacefully in their sleep. They have no choice in death, because all have sinned and all have come under the curse and all must face death sooner or later. Death is compulsory to our existence in this sinful world. But Jesus was different. Jesus was without sin. Jesus didn't need to die. It is as Ezekiel tells us so explicitly in the 18th chapter of the book that bears his name. It is the soul that sins that shall die. Jesus was without sin. Jesus didn't need to die. And yet there he hung on a Roman cross outside Jerusalem. Why? Why did Jesus die? Jesus died because he chose to die. Jesus died because he volunteered to die. Jesus' death on the cross was not an unavoidable accident. In his gospel, John records for us the words of Jesus teaching his disciples in chapter 10 and in verse 11. He says, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." But it isn't an accident. It isn't that a wild animal comes against the flock and the good shepherd goes out to meet that lion, that bear, that wild creature, and in the midst of the battle succumbs to the greater strength and ferocity of that creature. No, it's no accident. The good shepherd lays down his life. Indeed, Jesus makes it even more explicit when he says in verse 18 of the same chapter, "No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again." Jesus' death on the cross was no unavoidable accident. In Mark's Gospel and in chapter 10 and in verse 45, Jesus says, "Even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Again, in Matthew chapter 26 and in verse 53, when his disciples sought to defend him from the squad of soldiers who came to arrest him in the garden, and one of them, we're told, took out a sword, drew it, struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear, Jesus said, "Put your sword back into its place. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels?" Even there, at his arrest in the garden, Jesus voluntarily went with those soldiers. He didn't have to go with them. He could have defended himself. Again in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 27 and in verse 50. As Jesus hung upon the cross, we're told that he cried out with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Ecclesiastes teaches us some important lessons, and among them is this. In chapter 8 and verse 8, no man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. And yet, Jesus yielded up his spirit. It was Jesus' choice to let his spirit go. The very fact that he cried out with a loud voice indicates to us that there was still plenty of life left in his body. To have been able to do that on a cross when you were close to death would have been an impossibility. Jesus cried out with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. He died. He died by his own choice. His death was voluntary. He, uniquely out of all men in the world, didn't have to die. He, of all men in the world, chose to die. And he was different because his death was purposeful. We could go so far as to say that Jesus lived in order to die. That is in complete contrast to everyone else. Some people may navigate life rather aimlessly, without any apparent purpose. But most people have aims. Most people have ambitions. Most people see some kind of purpose, some kind of goal to work towards, even if it's only the accumulation of wealth or of happiness, contentment. That's their goal. But Jesus' goal was to die. His whole life was focused upon that single event with a determination to face it. In the Gospel of Matthew, we see this worked out as chapter after chapter he indicates to his disciples what would happen to him. For example, Mark chapter 8 and verse 31. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. In chapter 9 and verse 31, he told his disciples, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. And chapter 10 and verses 33 and 34, he said to them, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. You see, Jesus knew exactly what would befall him in Jerusalem as he made his way there. And he purposefully went to Jerusalem with this goal. Jesus lived with death as the climax of his life, not the conclusion of his life. Death would be his glory, not his destruction. Repeatedly in the Gospel of John, we read that his hour had not yet come. So that when the Jews came against him to arrest him, to kill him, to assassinate him, if you like. The explanation for why they did not succeed was that his hour had not yet come. And then there comes a point in John's narration of the life of Jesus that suddenly things change. And Jesus tells his disciples, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." He says, goes on to say, "Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." See, as we saw this morning, Jesus is glorified in his crucifixion. And the Father is glorified in his crucifixion. And the whole aim and purpose of Jesus' life was to die, crucified outside Jerusalem. But why? Why did Jesus volunteer to die? Why was it that consistently and persistently throughout his life he lived with the aim of dying, with the purpose of dying? Why? He died to save sinners. He died in order to free sinners from their destiny. It is appointed for man to die. To free them from that. Jesus didn't have to die. He chose to die in order to free those who had no choice with regard to death from having to die. In Romans chapter 5, for example, we read in verse 6, "While we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly." Paul goes on to say in the 8th verse, "God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Again, in 2 Corinthians and chapter 5, and in verse 21, Paul writes, "For our sake, God made Jesus to be sin. He knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." And the Apostle Peter, in his first letter, in chapter 3 and verse 18, says, "Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God." Jesus died. Jesus chose to die. Jesus purposefully set his life on a trajectory to a voluntary death for the sake of sinners. In the place of sinners, to be their substitute, to take their place. Some of the most graphic words to describe this event are found not in the New Testament, interestingly enough, but in the Old Testament, where in the book of Isaiah, and in the 53rd chapter, we read, "He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Jesus died in the place as a substitute for sinners. This is what Peter was referring to in that verse in chapter 3 and verse 18 of his first letter. Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. That was the purpose of his death, so that he could bring sinners to God, so that he could bring those who were under the curse to God. You see, when Adam and Eve ate the fruit from the forbidden tree in the Garden of Eden, they rebelled against God. And they brought upon themselves the curse of God. But not just upon themselves, because they represented the whole of humanity. All who would descend from them are tainted by their sin. We could even go so far as to say we're culpable with them in their disobedience. If we had been there, we would have done the same thing. And that brought mankind under the curse of God, under the wrath of God, having to bear the justice of God. And the death of Jesus on the cross was purposefully undertaken in order to free sinners from the curse, in order to remove from them the penalty of death. There are various words that the Bible uses in order to describe for us what Jesus did as a substitute for sinners. One of those words is the word propitiation. It appears 3 times in the New Testament, and the first of those occurrences is found in Romans chapter 3 and in verse 25. Jesus Christ, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood. Propitiation means to appease God's wrath. It means to fulfill the requirements of an offended person, to meet that person's demands in order to remove the offense and bring favor. Jesus' death on the cross propitiated God's wrath, absorbed God's wrath. It wasn't that God decided not to pour out his wrath upon men. It wasn't that somehow, through a bargain that Jesus made with God, God simply decided that he would not bring the curse of death upon mankind. No, not for a moment. What it means is that God poured out his wrath upon Jesus instead. of sinners. That God required Jesus to bear the punishment for sin instead of sinners. You see, propitiation requires that God's wrath is satisfied, that the offense is cleared up by meeting God's demands. It isn't that God writes things off, forgets about them. No, God deals with them, but he deals with them in the person of Jesus, rather than in the person of those sinners who have incurred his wrath and displeasure. Another word that is used to describe what took place as Jesus died as a substitute for sinners is the word redemption. It appears quite a number of times in the New Testament. One of them is found in the book of Galatians in chapter 4, where we read in verses 4 and 5 that when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. Redemption is a picture of purchasing something. It's closely associated with the payment of a ransom, to buy something back. People who pawn property in order to get a short-term loan, when they buy back their property, redeem it. Now, what is this picture then? Paul says that in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law. The idea is that those who are under the law are enslaved to the law. What is more, they are bound by a law that they cannot keep. They are slaves to this law because there is absolutely no way that they can perfectly keep the law and be freed from its demands. Jesus came to do that for them. In his death on the cross, he pays a ransom for them, freeing them from their bondage under the law. In other places, this redemption is put in terms of being redeemed from bondage to sin. It's the same idea. In Titus chapter 2 and in verse 14, Paul wrote that Jesus Christ gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession who are zealous for good works. And Peter also makes reference to this in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 18 and 19, where he writes, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. Jesus died on the cross in order to redeem those who were enslaved under the law in sin. He also died as a substitute for sinners in order to reconcile them to God. That's a word that is, I suppose, closely associated with propitiation. Propitiation is much fuller than the idea of reconciliation, but includes that idea. But reconciliation is explicitly mentioned a number of times in the New Testament, and we find it, for example, in Paul's letter to the church in Colossae. Colossians chapter 1 and verses 21 and 22. You who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before God. Reconcile. This is the idea of two parties who are at war with one another being brought into a relationship of peace. Man is God's enemy. Mankind fights a rebel warfare against God. He repeatedly dethrones God in his life, ignores God's commandments, and fails to give God his allegiance. Paul in Romans 8 and verse 7 says, "The mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God." Well, that's one side of the battle line. But there's another. And the reality is that God is man's enemy. God is man's enemy. When Adam and Eve ate the fruit in the Garden of Eden, and they brought themselves under the curse of God, God banished them from the garden, from everything good that he had provided for them, that pleasant place in which to live, those beautiful surroundings with its nourishing fruit. And God sent them out, where, by the sweat of his brow, mankind would work to live. Yes, on that day, man became God's enemy, but he also made God his enemy. So that Paul is able to write in chapter 1 and verse 18 of his letter to the church in Rome, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." The wrath of God is against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. God is at war with mankind. He has cursed the ground. He has cursed the womb. He has cursed this world. But Jesus came into this world in order to reconcile God and man, in order to bring them into a relationship of peace and harmony, of friendship once again. Indeed, Paul uses the language of adoption. Not just peace between nations, not just friends, but family. So complete is the reconciliation that Jesus accomplished in his death on the cross, in his appeasing of God's wrath by meeting God's demands in his purchase of sinners from their slavery to sin. Jesus brings them from a state of enmity into the loving embrace of a father. And a fourth word that is used to describe what Jesus did as a substitute for sinners is the word justification. Again, in Romans chapter 3, in verse 26, we're told that Jesus' death was to show God's righteousness so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. God must be just, or he ceases to be God. God's righteous anger against sin had to be met. We've already considered that in the idea of propitiation. Jesus died in order to show the justice of God, but also in order to justify sinners. The term justify means to put right, to make things good, so that the sinner who is marred by his rebellion against God is not only reconciled to God, but is perfected in himself. So that God doesn't simply overlook the sin in those who show allegiance to Jesus. It isn't just that he forgets the sin of those who plead the substitution of Jesus. It's that they are declared righteous because of Jesus. There's a two-way transaction that took place upon the cross. The sin of his people were imputed to Jesus, were reckoned to be his, and he died there bearing the punishment for those sins. But also on the cross, the righteousness of Jesus is imputed to sinners. It's described in the Bible in terms of a robe of salvation, a robe of righteousness, a covering. So that what God sees when he sees a sinner for whom Jesus has died is a righteous person, a holy person. No remnants of sin remains. No stain continues to exist because they have been justified by Christ. Jesus' death was a voluntary death. Jesus' death was a purposeful death. And finally, Jesus' death was a thorough death. Death in the Bible doesn't mean a conclusion. It means a separation. It doesn't mean annihilation. It means a continuing existence in a different way. When Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, Jesus has said they would surely, God said rather, that they would surely die. And we tend to think, well, they didn't. They carried on living. Adam actually lived for over 900 years. That is hardly death. And some people explain it away and they say, well, he began to die. He was on a trajectory towards death. And that is true. But you see, the point is that at the moment, at the very moment that Adam and Eve took a mouthful of that fruit, they died. Because death is separation. Principally, death is the separation of the soul from God. Secondarily, death is the separation of the soul from the body. At the moment that Adam took the fruit to his lips and bit into it, he was separated from God. It's illustrated by the fact that as soon as he heard God in the garden coming to meet him, to walk with him in the cool of the day, he hid himself. That enmity is there all of a sudden. It hadn't been there before. Perfect friendship had existed before. Fellowship. Communication. But now, Adam hides himself. A gulf has been opened between him and God, you see, that separates him. And certainly, at the same time, a change began to take place in the physical realm. And his body, rather than remaining healthy and strong, began to deteriorate and to weaken. And ultimately, it would end up in the separation of his soul from his body. But the primary thing that we need to understand is that at the moment that he disobeyed God, he was separated from God. That is real death. And Jesus' death on the cross as a substitute for sinners was a thorough death. Yes, Jesus hung there in excruciating pain, just like the other two men, each side of him, and like thousands upon thousands of others who died upon crosses during the Roman reign. Jesus died physically there on the cross. The thrusting of the spear into his side ensured that that was true. When he was taken down from the cross, the centurion had absolutely no hesitation in informing Pilate that this man was a dead man. But before that had happened, Jesus was separated from God. Jesus hung on that cross as a substitute for sinners. And there came a point after some hours of hanging there that he lifted up his voice and he cried out, "My God! My God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus, the Son of God, was cut off from the Father because of the sins of his people. Jesus' death on the cross was a thorough death. It involved the fullness of the curse. Jesus died completely, both physically and spiritually, that day. The Son of God, incarnated, perfect in obedience, voluntarily allowed himself to be separated from God the Father, so that I, a rebel sinner, could be united with the Father. Were the whole realm of nature mine? That were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all.